Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Increasingly, Pacific people in New Zealand are trying to negotiate issues like culture, identity, and poverty in their struggle with mental illness. Health services have been called on to adapt their practices to suit. While those in distress are looking to draw strength from their family heritage, but avoid cultural pitfalls that can ensnare simultaneously. In this report from Karora Vanuatu, some names have been changed to protect their identities.
One in five people in New Zealand are said to suffer from depression of some form. Agencies say with many in the Pacifica community dealing with poverty and trauma, depression could be even more prevalent among them. Some of Salote's earliest memories are full of sadness.
Sharing this really tiny flat with my family, we were all crunched up into this two-bedroom flat. There was about 12 of us, and I remember feeling sad and thinking, is this how my life is going to be? And I was just not happy at all. And I remember hoping that I would wake up and be somewhere else richer, because to me, being poor was not a nice thing.
Salote, born in New Zealand to Tongan and Samoan parents, also struggled to find an identity of her own in her early years, leading to depression and later suicidal thoughts.
When you're a half-caste, quarter-caste, whatever, it is hard when it comes to identity, because you have all these people trying to say to you, who are you? I remember growing up and having both families, one family going, you are not really a Samoan because you can't speak the language. You are not really Tongan because you can't speak the language. And it was hard enough to grow up in New Zealand, as an islander anyway.
Feletti's mental distress began with the breakdown of his relationship with his father on the back of a tragic death in their lives. However, he found solace initially in a new relationship with his soon-to-be Samoan wife before being led to seek help with a university counsellor. He says he's seen a lot of the Pacifica community suffering.
It's kind of in some ways like a virus. It doesn't discriminate and it's wide-ranging and it's pervasive and soul-destroying. It doesn't matter if you live in Remuera or in Flaxmere. We're susceptible as human beings to some form of depression or feeling down or not being able to cope.
Anita is a Samoan woman brought up in Hawke's Bay, where a traumatic experience during her school years triggered what she later learnt was clinical depression. She didn't feel she could share what she was going through with her family at the time.
It's a big burden for a teenage, 12-year-old, to think you don't want to sadden your parents, you've got to pretend that everything's okay. Being the eldest, I also had to look out for my sisters.
However, she says the cultural concept of tamato helped her.
The idea that we're all warriors and that we're all fighters, that was very important because my parents certainly were survivors and they were fighters. That's the thing that they taught, you know, that you've got to fight for what you want. We are warriors, you know, descendants of warriors. The only thing that kept me going when I have fallen into a terrible state of depression is that, yeah, I'm not going to let this beat me.
The impact of culture on mental health is no surprise to Monique Faliafa, the CEO of Leva, an NGO specialising in Pacifica health issues.
What we've got really strong evidence for now for young Pacific people is the stronger their cultural identity, the stronger their mental well-being. I get people asking, well, is it culture or is it mental illness or wellness? And for me, they're inseparable. They're both intertwined. The stronger the culture, the stronger the well-being.
Mary Maringikura Campbell from Te Korowai Whariki, part of Wellington's Public Mental Health Services, agrees that it's important to know your family history so you have something to connect with. Ms. Maringikura Campbell also says young people need to be equipped with coping mechanisms to deal with bad times.
If we bring up our children, for example, to think that life is going to be great, we don't bring up our children to actually say, life is going to be great, but there's going to be some really hard times where, you know, life's shit, you know, and it's learning about coping with, you know, all the bumps on the road.
Ms. Maringikura Campbell says Pacifica are some of the most stigmatised patient groups in New Zealand.
We don't have the same stigma when someone gets cancer, they get a lot of support, people feel very sad for them, but there's still this sort of feeling that people with mental illness have done something to deserve it, have done something wrong, maybe they've breached a tapu or whatever it is, it's their fault.
Ms. Maringikura Campbell says if people were looked at holistically as emotional and spiritual rather than just a physical body, there may be a reduction of stigma. In the meantime, she says the sector should customise its approach to Pacifica, as psychiatric care is based on a Western model which doesn't always meld well with them. Auckland has a dedicated Pacific team, but Ms. Maringikura Campbell says the rest of the country has a shortage of Pacifica nurses, doctors and psychologists.
Slowly we're getting more and more Pacific psychiatric nurses coming through, but you have to also understand that forensic and psychiatric nursing is not a very attractive pathway for many nurses. So a lot of the nurses that we get come from England, so they're imported, so they're totally different culture.
Ms. Maringikura Campbell says a lack of health literacy means staff and consumers can talk past each other and people can feel intimidated when entering the system. Monique Valiafa says specific programs must be produced for Pacifica communities and most importantly, services must make themselves more accessible.
The biggest problem we have in New Zealand is that our Pacific families and communities seem to have extremely high rates of mental illness, but really low rates of access to services. And what we see is Pacific families accessing in crisis. We could have saved so much grief and disruption and distress for that family if we had have intervened early.
Salote and Anita have accessed services in the past, and Filetti encourages others to do so.
Seek help. And I know within Pacific Island culture there's a real sense of pride, of doing it yourself and standing on your own 2 feet with your head held high. But mental illness is such a serious problem, and it can manifest itself later on in life into attitudes and behaviours that can really destroy.
All three are in a good place at the moment, but acknowledge depressing times can be expected. Anita doesn't fear them.
My particular mental illness has actually driven me forward because as much as I do have those moments, I also want to overcome those moments and become a better person and to create a life where I am a happier person and I'm more satisfied. So it's always that one dark moment can push me to create better moments.
And that's the key. Health worker, trainer, sufferer all say it's okay to be depressed, but your experiences must be shared and talked about. This is Koro Vakauta.
The deputy leader of the opposition says Fiji should not be a member of the Inter-Parliamentary Union, or IPU. If the government does not abide by its recommendations to lift the suspensions of two MPs. Ratu Asoa Tiaka was suspended from parliament in September over statements that targeted Muslims, while Tupou Dranudalo was suspended in June for calling a government minister a fool. The Geneva-based IPU says the comments fell within the opposition's rights of free speech and their suspensions have no legal basis. Leader of the National Federation Party, Biman Prasad, told Ben Robinson Drawbridge that if Fiji is to remain a member of the IPU, the government must adhere to its standards.
We had already said in Parliament that the suspension meted out to Ratuisoa and Rokotopodonondalo was unreasonable and uncalled for. And I'm sure the opposition will raise that issue when we sit again in February next year. So we expect the government, which has the majority in Parliament, to take heed of the recommendations by the IPU. However, we all know that this government has been an extremist government, unreasonable government in the sense that it has not been tolerant with respect to all the three cases that were brought before the Privileges Committee and then into Parliament. But we do hope that given the recommendations of the IPU and given that we, Fiji, is part of IPU and that we attend all their meetings and we pretend that we adhere to their principles and norms and practices, then we should see the suspension lifted in the February sitting.
All right, but if the government decides not to lift the suspensions, would you like to see further action from the IPU?
It should. I mean, the IPU should take further action, and I would go to the extent of saying that if the government doesn't take heed of the recommendations by the IPU, and if it doesn't support lifting of the suspension as recommended by the IPU, then Fiji really has no right to be a member of IPU.
The IPU's raised further concerns about how outspoken opposition MPs are treated in Fiji. So do you think it's fair to say they have some concern about democracy in your country?
As we have always articulated, I mean, our democracy is really a facade if you look at the number of indicators. First, if you look at the short parliamentary sittings, the last time we were able to ask questions in Parliament was in May or June. The next sitting where we'd be able to ask questions is in February. So obviously making a mockery of parliamentary sitting. Then there are cases where government has used its majority in Parliament to change the standing orders. In fact, we've had three changes to the standing orders. And there are many other examples where the draconian decrees, such as the political parties decree, the media decree, the elections decree, all these decrees are draconian decrees, you know, and as long as these decrees are in place, we cannot call ourselves a genuine democracy.
Do you think, though, this climate in the Fiji Parliament will discourage other opposition MPs from speaking out?
Well, the punishment or the suspension, as I said, was unwarranted and unreasonable, and is a warning to other members of Parliament that government can use its numbers to mete out unreasonable punishment, like, you know, suspension for the rest of the term. So obviously it would have had a chilling effect on other members of the opposition.
Papua New Guinea's National Research Institute has welcomed an announcement that all special agricultural business leases in PNG will be cancelled. The SABL system was subject of a 2012 commission of inquiry, which found that the majority of leases were mainly used for forestry and largely fraudulently obtained. Over 5 million hectares of land, or more than 10% of PNG's total landmass, is estimated to have been affected by the illegal leases. The Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, announced last week that the Department of Lands has been instructed to cancel all SABLs because it doesn't want rightful landowners to lose their rights to the land. He said where projects exist on SABLs, the government encourages the landowners to renegotiate leases arrangements with the developers. An NRI researcher for the Property Development Research Program, Eugene Izalolo, said the onus is now on converting SABLs into customary lease arrangements. He spoke to Johnny Blades.
Customary lease, which involves customary landowners coming together to form a group, a registered as group of people owning a piece of land in the form of what you refer to as incorporated land group. Then after that, then the next thing will be for them to register their land in order for them to have a land title, which you refer to as a voluntary customary land registration system. But the SABL negates from this type of system, therefore making the customary landowners not to benefit as much as they could. So that is one of the reasons we have been advocating for voluntary customary land registration process. So with the cancellation of SABL, then the next thing will be to bring out guidelines of a way to dismantle SABL and convert SABL to customary lease so that the customary landowners could benefit.
Remember, at the start of the SABLs, it was always meant to be that the landowners would also benefit from the SABL system. On paper, it didn't sound like a bad idea, but it's just that the way it was always implemented, or mainly implemented, where lots of the customary landowners weren't consulted and so forth. Well, I mean, how can we be sure that converting it to this new arrangement is going to work either?
Yes, the system has been tried already. Like, we have a case of Todukwa where, and this has been tried, SABL was converted to customary lease, and the customary owner, they really applauded that, and I think they are also benefiting from it, because with this, the customary landowners, they will, you know, have the chance, opportunity to negotiate directly with the developer or the potential developer. But for the SABL case, they were not fully involved in negotiating regarding what they get or what they are being offered. So with the customary lease system, then the customary landowners, they'll be fully involved in negotiating what they get.
Right. So yes. How's this practically going to work? It's a little bit hard to understand, I feel, because we understand that SABLs are still operating. They're not actually being removed for having fraudulently obtained leases.
Yeah, anyway, currently SABL are still operating until such a time when guidelines have been developed, released, and be used in dismantling SABL. So for now, it still operates. So what the Prime Minister mentioned on Monday, it was an announcement, but it's not what we start just immediately, because there will be need for us to develop a guideline that will be used for the dismantled SABL and converting it to customary lease. Yes, the announcement was made by the Prime Minister on Monday that SABL has been cancelled. But at the same time, after this cancellation, the next thing now will be to develop a guideline that will be used for dismantling the SABL so that the SABL could be converted to customary lease. So that will be the next step.
Yeah, and who will do that? Who will develop this mechanism?
The government agency in charge of lands, had the power to do that.
And you would trust them to do that?
The policymakers are there, so they have to do that. But the next step now is to develop guidelines to do so, to follow the decision.
Church groups around the region of the Pacific are calling for justice on long-standing issues undermining the rights of the region's peoples. At a recent gathering in Auckland, New Zealand, the Pacific Conference of Churches General Secretary discussed the issue as West Papua, climate change, the legacy of nuclear testing, and the militarization of the Pacific. Indira Stewart was there.
In his presentation, General Secretary Francois Pihatai pointed to the Protestant Church in French Polynesia and their decision to take France to the International Criminal Court over the impact of decades of nuclear testing. Mr. Pihatai added that church leaders played a key role in ending French nuclear testing in the territory in 1996. He says this shows that the united voice of church groups shouldn't be underestimated.
When the church speaks, it's not only the church, it's also the people. Because most of the time we have the people with us. We cannot ignore also the unity of the people at the grassroots level, because they hold the power to speak.
A New Zealand human rights activist, Myra Ledbetter, agreed, pointing to the church's influence in West Papua's bid for self-determination.
There's only one reason, I think, why we've had seven Pacific nations speak out strongly in the United Nations General Assembly, and that's because the pressure's coming from the grassroots. And a big part of that grassroots pressure in the Pacific is coming from the churches.
Mr. Pihatai says more church groups are uniting and pressuring political leaders to speak out about West Papua. For the first time since the body was established 20 years ago, the Papua New Guinea Council of Churches also joined the call to support West Papua's bid for decolonisation. He says council members want Indonesia's government to end what he calls the genocide of West Papuans.
A call to Indonesia to stop killing these people. That's the only first priority for us, is to call Indonesia military or police, whatever means they are using to kill the people. They are not human, they are not animals. They are human beings like themselves, Indonesian. And the second thing we are trying to do is to take the issue of West Papua on the decolonization list, in order that for them to enjoy freedom like other Pacific Islanders who are independent, free.
Mr. Pihatai says the council includes West Papua churches and wants them to know that they're not alone.
We have right now two member churches in West Papua, and we will welcome another two next year. So that means through our action we are trying to bring back our West Papua people to home, to the Pacific, where they belong to.
Other issues included the impact of resource extraction on the environment, the non-communicable diseases epidemic, and the church's role in combating violence against women, as raised by one member of the Quaker Church in a Q&A session.
I was in Tonga last year when the government was ready to ratify CEDAW, the Convention on All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And it was the churches mostly who led the backlash against that, which stopped that convention being ratified. I acknowledge it's not Indigenous piece of way of approaching things, but it was a backward step for Tom and women.
Mr. Pihaatai says the church is actively seeking the participation of men in efforts to combating violence against women.
Dealing the issue of women with women doesn't work. Then we started that new approach. We call the men in and create a workshop for men, and it works well.
Mr. Pihaatai says the council will continue to bring the people of the Pacific together to fight for justice and peace to protect their collective future. This is Indira Stewart.
A resident of New Caledonia's South says residents are getting sick of roadblocks formed by clashes between police and armed Kanak men. Police in the territory have again closed the main road to the south of Nyamiro because of clashes, only weeks after five police officers were shot during a confrontation which led to a three-day roadblock. The mayor of Monte Dores says the latest attacks are being carried out by dangerous and uncontrollable individuals, and Paris has pledged to send extra police to the territory. Tiona Chulula lives in Monte Dores, says the roadblocks are preventing people from going to work in Niamey, and supermarkets and petrol stations are running out of supplies. She told Jamie Tahanaha that life in the south has become very difficult.
As somebody who lives in Mondor, south of Saint Louis is known as a trouble spot because there's a minority of, you know, I guess, young disenfranchised men who will sort of jump at any excuse, you know, to go and block the road, and they, you know, burn tires and throw stones at cars going past. And so over this last weekend, the road has been closed again, and they're burning cars so nobody can get past. So we just safety precaution that the police have closed off the road.
What effect has this had south of the roadblocks?
Well, the population is really just sick of it because most people living out this way have to go into Nyamiro for work, you know, and for everything, really. So basically what's happened now is that the city council has set up sort of like a ferry service for emergencies. So people are being ferried from a wharf here in the south of Saint Louis to another wharf which is just north of Saint Louis. But, you know, they don't have enough boats. I think there might even just be one official boat. So all the other ferry services are being run by volunteers, just people living this way who have boats.
What about food supplies, fuel and things like that? Has that been able to get through?
No, that wouldn't. Well, fuel not, but food supplies, there are a couple of that have been set up for people just to keep each other informed. And I was looking at that this morning and I saw a boat arriving with bread to replenish the supermarket stocks out this way. There's one supermarket. I haven't been there since yesterday to the supermarket, but I know that what happened last time is that they ran out of a lot of stock, so all the sort of basic necessities. And we also ran out of gas for cooking, and so that we'd run out of that last time, and I'm not too sure what the situation is now, whether there are stocks available or not.
So this one skirmish is affecting quite a large population to the south of Nyamiro.
Yes. It's I think there are 12,000 people, I believe that's the population of everyone living south. So it's basically affecting quite a major part of the population. Yeah. So all the primary schools out this way are closed. There's a junior high school that's open, and my daughter goes there. But we decided just to keep her home this morning because half the teachers come this way from Nyamiro anyway. So there wouldn't be many teachers there. And also the baccalaureate, which is the high school leaving exams, they started today in Nyamiro, but there were quite a few students on this side of Saint Louis who couldn't make it there. So the education department set up junior high school as an examination center. This morning, only 10 out of about 600 students had turned up. So it's obviously, you know, having an effect, a big effect on families and people.
A Samoan filmmaker says anti-violence efforts failed Pacific people because the issue is tackled from a foreign perspective. Stephen Purcell has produced a number of films on gender inequality in Samoa and brought his latest film on violence against women and girls to New Zealand. He told Danielle Marathori Cox, he hopes using a proverb to title the film, Sise Lelale Afa, Rise of the Senate Sail, will challenge Samoan people to rethink their ideas about gender roles.
The proverb in the Samoan language goes, Ae lele matangi, sisi lela afala, ae a luka luka le aso, sisi lela afa. The La Afa is the Senet sail, which is much, much stronger than the La Fala. The La Fala is the woven bandana sail. And the proverb essentially says if it's a calm day, if the winds are gentle, then you can use the bandana sail. But if it's blustery, stormy conditions, then fishermen and the sailors, the ocean voyagers, they knew straight away to change the bandana sail to the Senet sail, which would allow the vessel to continue to journey, to voyage, without damaging the sails. And I'm using it as an analogy, basically about how we in societies around the world, including the Samoan society, have to find those mechanisms, those ways of journeying into the future that will lead us to a violence-free societies.
Why use a proverb to try and help spread the message about this?
Well, one of the weaknesses, as I see it, in the discourse on violence and ending violence is that it's most often tackled from the way foreigners try to explore the issues and the subject. So I, in all my filmmaking, I always try to find something that is, has a very strong reference to the old culture of Samoa.
Was it difficult for you to find people who would open up to you about their experiences?
It was very easy to actually get people speaking about this issue, because my Samoan society is an oral society and they very much like speaking, very confident speakers. And it's an issue that a lot of people have very clear attitudes towards, especially when you're discussing something like gender relations, because in Samoa the gender relations are fairly well defined in stereotypical ways. And the Bible is often referred to bolster the attitude and the view about the station of man and the station of woman. It's an issue that everyone has something to say in Samoa about. Unfortunately, sometimes what they say doesn't gel with international standards or views.
Do you have a different hope for people who view it in Samoa, what they will take away from it from people who might view it elsewhere?
Yes, I think I do. I think I'm hoping that the Samoans who view this, especially in Samoa, we'll look at it and walk away from the film thinking that perhaps some of the methodologies that they employ when it comes to gender relations. So I'm hoping that viewers can walk away from the film in Samoa thinking perhaps this is not the right way, that perhaps there's another way of looking at the issue. And similarly, the issue of leadership in families or the headship, and it's oft quoted scripture of the Bible is that man is the head of the woman, and that is often used as an argument or justification for the actions of men in relationships. And in the case of this man is the head of woman, I'm hoping that viewers will walk away and think twice about what that really means, how do we interpret that, because it can't be used to justify violence. And unfortunately, a lot of these behaviors have now become normalized in society.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Our email is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you all, saying so long and take care.